From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are no talks in sight between Democrats and Republicans to reach a deal to help millions of Americans struggling financially during the pandemic. Eviction protection and $600 per week in extended unemployment benefits expired last month. Talks between Congress and the White House fell apart Friday, although earlier today, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said he thought there would be compromise. But meanwhile, on Saturday, President Trump signed four measures to get around Congress, extending unemployment to $400 per week extra, but making states pay for part of it and taking money from FEMA disaster relief in the middle of hurricane season. Let's bring in NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe, who's been following this. Hi, Ayesha.
Hello.
And we know Democrats want to keep the $600 in extended unemployment. Republicans wanted $200. They say more takes away the incentive to go back to work. Here's the president with $400. Now, he doesn't have the power of the purse constitutionally. So first, are his actions enforceable?
There are a lot of legal questions about these actions, particularly the unemployment benefits. A legal expert that talked to my colleague, Tamara Keith, said that when it comes to money for unemployment, there could certainly be lawsuits because it seems like the president is calling for money to be spent in a way that Congress did not necessarily authorize. So these actions that he's looking at will likely face legal challenges. And there's also the question of how they would actually be implemented. Even if he tries to move forward with it, there's a lot of confusion over how they would actually be implemented.
Right, and whether states can afford it. He initially said states would pay 25% or $100 for every $400 per week check. Yesterday, he backtracked. States might not have to pay. Governors saying maybe we can't. Democrat Ned Lamont of Connecticut wondered if he should take the money from COVID-19 testing. Republican Mike DeWine of Ohio says his state may not be able to afford it. So, you know, the question is, how soon might this happen under Trump's plan?
There are no real answers right now coming from the administration. You had President Trump's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow. He was on the news shows yesterday, and he didn't have specific answers about, you know, even the amount of the money that people would get. They don't know what states would actually be able to pony up. And then you have, as you pointed out, states are already overwhelmed. So how are you expecting them to also come up with this money or to disperse this money? We know that even under the program that expired at the end of July, that some people waited months and months to get their unemployment checks. And we're still waiting. So now you have the president trying to do something that's totally unprecedented. And even with all of that said, the money allocated to back this would likely only last a handful of weeks before running out. So even when if they were to get some checks out of the door, it would not last for long. So it's not a long-term solution.
And what about the president's memorandum to pause payroll tax collection, businesses and the self-employed not having to pay this tax, you know, for a while? But then when it comes due, won't it be much bigger? This isn't forgiven. It's deferred.
No, it would be deferred. The president can delay the deadline for collecting taxes up to a year when you have an emergency declaration. It's kind of like what they did with the income tax, where they pushed the deadline, back to July 15th instead of April 15th. But that does not forgive the taxes. They would still be owed. And the president cannot unilaterally forgive taxes. That would have to be done through Congress.
Well, you know, there's also a question of whether or not deferring that would hurt Social Security, because, you know, that's what those taxes go to pay for. But he also issued an executive order on evictions. What does that propose to do?
So the executive order on evictions actually just directs the government to look at what they can do to help people who may be evicted, to look at funds that they may be able to provide, and to see if they can put in for the federal government to look at whether they should extend some help or relief to people so they don't get evicted if they decide that it is a threat to health. So that order doesn't actually extend eviction relief. It tells the government to look at it.
Yeah. And extended relief for student loan borrowers. How would that work in the time we have?
Yeah, so student loan interest rates were cut to zero earlier this year, and students could suspend their payments through September. Now Trump is pushing that back through the end of the year, and he is saying that there could be an extension even longer than that.
And Aisha, what happens if Congress does come up with a deal? Do these executive actions just kind of go away?
Presumably, that's what would happen, and that the president would step back, and that he would kind of, you know, I think part of this is trying to force a deal in the meantime to try to force action. But, it's not clear right now that the sides are really coming together.
And I was just going to say, in the few seconds we have, do you see any side letting go? You know, the Republicans maybe coming up from 200 or Democrats down from 6?
Well, I mean, both sides are saying that, you know, they need to come find some middle ground. And so that certainly may be possible. The White House and the administration is going to be facing pressure, because now that you've done these executive orders, people are going to expect to see something happen. And if things aren't happening fast, they're going to want to make a deal.
White House reporter Aisha Roscoe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Concerns continue to mount about mail-in voting as the Trump administration challenges voting rules and makes changes to the Postal Service leading up to November's election. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, the start of in-person, one-stop early voting is just 2 months away, and election officials are scrambling to make certain they have enough volunteers to work the polls despite health risks because of the coronavirus. From North Carolina Public Radio, Rusty Jacobs reports.
Ann Mobies signed up to work the polls for the first time in the March 3rd primaries and loved it. The 62-year-old retired attorney in western North Carolina's Buncombe County served as a precinct judge and said she was looking forward to helping out again.
I just was so jazzed about it. I didn't expect to really like it and find it as rewarding as I did.
But then the coronavirus pandemic hit the U.S., and she decided that at her age, with a predisposition to clotting, it's highly unlikely she'll volunteer this fall.
I would say that it would take a vaccine before I would be comfortable doing it, and even then, I'm not sure.
Health concerns like these contributed to poll worker shortages and hours-long waits for voters in Wisconsin's April primaries. In Milwaukee, the number of polling sites on Election Day went from 180 to just 5 because there weren't enough volunteers to staff them. This is why elections officials, lawmakers, and other policymakers are intensifying recruiting efforts and increasing incentives for the thousands of poll workers needed at 2,700 precincts across North Carolina on Election Day and at one-stop sites for early voting. Gary Sims is the elections director in Wake County, where the school system has made Election Day a teacher work day, freeing up students who might be able to help out at the polls.
Just trying to get maybe a younger crowd involved.
Elections assistants may be as young as 17. Many of the jobs at polling places this year will entail handing out face masks to voters, sanitizing voting booths after each use, and keeping voters safely and socially distanced. And getting younger volunteers is crucial, since the average age of poll workers in North Carolina is upwards of 60. Damon Sercosta chairs the State Board of Elections.
That's a population that's particularly concerned about coronavirus and in one of the vulnerable populations, according to the CDC.
Addison Gray is a 30-year-old school nurse in Wake County. She signed up to work the polls this fall after seeing a public service announcement on social media.
And it pays like up to $200 a day. And I was like, oh, that's kind of enticing.
Recently enacted state legislation provides additional hazard pay for poll workers and funding to help counties acquire enough personal protective equipment. The legislation also allows unemployed people to continue receiving benefits while collecting a stipend as a poll worker. But Gray says for her, volunteering is not about the money. She was motivated by the calls for social and racial justice in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer.
I felt like I needed to be a better citizen with all of the unrest that's going on. I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what I should do.
Wake County is home to the state capital, Raleigh. The county has more than 200 voting precincts and a large and growing population, which eases concerns about recruiting enough poll workers. But out west, in small, rural Clay County, Elections Director Rebecca Hall says with an older population, she's concerned fears of getting sick could make recruiting pretty hard, as she saw with the runoff in the GOP primary for Congress.
We actually lost five or six just for this runoff.
On the eastern side of the state, in Chowan County, 65-year-old June Britt says her doctor advised her not to return as a member of a multi-partisan assistance team this year. The two-person teams go to nursing homes to help residents fill out registration and absentee ballot request forms.
I came down with bronchitis, and now I have asthma.
But Britt says she will work as a chief precinct judge at a polling site, even though her doctor would prefer she didn't. She says she thinks she'll have more control in that setting to distance herself from others.
Being able to vote is a privilege and an honor.
And Britt says helping others to vote is a blessing. For Here and Now, I'm Rusty Jacobs.
A heat wave in Europe is complicating efforts to tamp down COVID-19. Temperatures have soared into the 90s and people are seeking relief in the water. A brawl broke out in Belgium when police asked people to leave an overcrowded beach. And with infections rising in France, where it is also very hot, there are new rules for mask wearing. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from a restaurant in Nice. And Mark, explain the new rules.
Well, the rules came into force earlier on today, Tanya, for areas in and around Paris, 100 areas there where wearing of a mask is now obligatory outside, in order to try to bring down a spike in coronavirus cases around that area. Now, that means that Paris and the area around that city now echoes the city from where I'm speaking to you, Nice, where for some days now there has been a rule to enforce mask wearing in large parts of the city centre. And if you are caught without a mask, you risk a fine, €120 for the first time you are caught. That's about $150. That goes up to €1,500 for a second offence and €3,750 and a six-month possible prison sentence for a third offence. But I have to say that police have been told to be fairly lenient at the moment and not issue the fines. And at the moment, we are not seeing that the mask wearing is particularly strictly enforced or that many people are actually wearing masks in the city centre.
Mark, this is culturally significant because France is known for outdoor dining and folks gathering outdoors. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a country that takes food very seriously indeed. And outside dining, of course, in the summer months is very much the done thing. It's also a country where it gets very, very hot in the summer. So now when we were out in the city centre earlier and we were asking some people why they were not wearing masks, they said it's just too hot. And I said to one lady, but you know, you're risking a fine. And she said, well, I'm going to take that risk because it's just too hot to wear it. If I go into a shop, I will wear it. But, you know, France is worried about the rise in cases here. It's at a two-month high, the infection rate. It is the country in Europe with the third highest number of deaths, over 30,000. And they are very, very worried that they're on the cusp of a second wave here.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that heat wave that you all are experiencing there in France. You're in the French Riviera on the southeast coast of the country. This has really made fighting the virus really hard, as you said, because it's so abnormally hot.
Yeah, indeed. And on the beaches, you see some people wearing masks before they go in for a swim, but on the whole, you don't. So it'll be a question now of whether the police begin to enforce it more tightly. And I think that very much depends on the rate of infections over the coming days. The level it's at the moment here, now the infections, it makes France a possible contender to be the next European country on which Britain would impose quarantine. So visitors from France could face mandatory quarantine when they travel to Britain in the coming days. We're waiting for an announcement on that. And if that happens, that would hit the French tourism industry very, very badly indeed.
That's the BBC's Mark Lowen speaking to us from Nice, France. Mark, thank you so much.
Pleasure to talk to you, Tanya.
Well, how about an escapist summer read? J. Courtney Sullivan writes a lot about female friendships. Her 2010 novel Commencement was set at her alma mater, Smith College, and began as an homage to Mary McCarthy's classic The Group, which was set at hers, Vassar. And The Group is being read by a gossipy neighborhood book club in Courtney's new novel, Friends and Strangers, which is about book clubs and message boards for moms like the one Courtney actually belonged to in Brooklyn. And inequity, particularly on college campuses. Some students work in the cafeteria, others study abroad. But it's also about babysitting. I recently led a Zoom talk with Courtney, sponsored by a consortium of libraries. Great fun, over an hour. Here's a little of that talk. It's about babysitting, which can be a profound experience. It sure was for me. Many years ago, there was a car accident. Everyone was okay, but Annie Titel, please get in touch. That's the thing. That powerful babysitting experience is ephemeral. Everyone, the hiring mom, the babysitter, the baby, moves on. Maybe, as in the case of Courtney's fictional mom, Elizabeth, and the college girl she hires, Sam, they might have trouble recognizing each other. They were friends and strangers. I asked J. Courtney Sullivan, why babysitting?
I think those of us who were babysitters, we understand something about the very specific rite of passage that that is. Several years ago, I want to say maybe 8 or 9 years ago, I was at Smith College, my alma mater, to give a reading. After the event, I was going to my car and I'm standing in the crosswalk. It starts to rain, of course, because it's a very cinematic moment. And this big SUV pulls up, and behind the wheel of the SUV is this woman, this mother, who's baby girl I used to babysit for my senior year of college. And she very much put me on the path that I ended up on. You know, she really encouraged me to be a writer, which is what I wanted most of all in the world, and introduced me to so many of her friends and was just such a lovely, lovely presence in my life. But as you said, that year, my senior year that I spent babysitting for her daughter, I felt we were very close. And so here it's 10 years later, I see her, I immediately know who she is. And I'm like, hi, oh my gosh, it's me. She had no idea who I was. And she just kept driving. And so that night I was having dinner back in Brooklyn with a friend who is also a novelist. And I was telling her this whole story. And I was like, we were so close. And then, you know, she didn't even know who I was. And Jamie said, oh, that sounds like it would be a great jumping off point for a novel. Mm-hmm. And when you're a fiction writer, you know, there are moments and ideas and things that have this kind of shimmer around them where, you know, I'm going to write about that. You know, many years went by and then I was pregnant with my first child. And this story was just really calling to me because I felt like now I've been the babysitter. Soon I'm going to be the mother. I'm going to know what it's like from both of these women's point of view. And I'd love to write this kind of conversation between them, which in many ways is kind of a conversation with my younger self. And also, I had a piece in the New York Times this weekend about babysitting, and I mentioned this woman in the piece, and she ended up emailing me. And so now we're back in touch, which is so wonderful. That's Isn't that nice?
Yeah, you know, you sent me, I've been Googling these poor children that I used to babysit for who are like 50 now.
Oh, wow.
But you made me do that. The New York Times in their review also point out that reading and babysitting share a distinct pleasure. They're both pulling back a curtain to see how the other people live. And I thought to myself, oh, little do they know. I mean, nobody's listening, right? You could go like see if they had like dirty magazines. And I'm talking about like back then that was Playboy. I mean, we're not, you know, you could eat all their ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, to be in someone else's home when it's asleep, the house is literally asleep, it feels like. The curtains are asleep. Late at night is a very intimate thing.
It's the best. I remember knowing exactly how much ice cream you could take out of the container without getting chips.
Right.
So, you know, you take like 2 cookies out of the box and some ice cream and just a little bit here and there.
Yeah,
you know?
Take the cookies from the back of the box.
Exactly.
And see something like the, you know, your own parents are such a puzzle. And mm-hmm. Here's a couple. You're watching them too. You're watching them and their family. And how are they functioning, especially if it's different from your family?
Yes, very much so. Especially the mothers. They are these models of possible adulthood. It's true that, you know, people say like no one knows what happens behind closed doors, but your babysitter does know, because at a certain point, you forget that the babysitter is there. And that is where I, you know, sort of cut my teeth on being a nosy eavesdropper, which is essential for fiction writing.
And babysitting.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and it's a reminder too, again, a lot of us are having flashbacks to our babysitting days. I'm reading somebody's comment. I remember babysitting and being shocked that the mother had Wifey by Judy Blume on her show.
Oh. You know, I had some really intense situations like you described too. I cared for these two little girls when I was in college. And their mom asked me at one point, she said, my sister could really use your help. So I said, oh, okay. And this poor woman, her husband had been a doctor. She had two little boys and she was like 8 months pregnant with a third little boy and her husband died of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so these kids, I mean, like I was coming into their home and this had just happened. And the little baby had just been born when I first came along. And there was such an air of just, you know, sorrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was such a heartbreaking place to be, but then also like young children always add joy. So there was also joy and there was a brand new baby, which is a whole other emotional journey. And it just, I mean, I was such a part of their lives. And in that case, it was such a short time. I couldn't tell you their names now. I couldn't pick them out of a lineup and I'm sure they couldn't me either, but we just experienced this intensity together. Yeah. And you know, that happens with babysitting. I think that happens with friendships too. Like personally, the older I get, the more I'm just so grateful for my female friends. But I think you also do have these friendships over time. For whatever reason, you know, that friendship might actually change you in a very profound way, but not last. And I think that's what's going on in this book.
In Chicago, more than 100 people were arrested after a night of looting and vandalism on Magnificent Mile, the high-end shopping area. Today, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot called it an assault on our city.
This is not legitimate First Amendment protected speech. These were not poor people engaged in petty theft to feed themselves and their families. This was straight up felony criminal conduct.
Videos on social media show littered streets, people leaving ransacked stores with bags of merchandise. A video even showed a car smashing through a glass window as dozens looked on. As more people arrived, the police presence grew, gunshots were exchanged, officials say several officers were injured, and that the chaos could have been linked to the shooting and injury of a male suspect by police in the city's Southside neighborhood of Englewood earlier on Sunday. Let's bring in WBEC reporter Patrick Smith. So Patrick, today, Police Superintendent David Brown said what happened last night on Magnificent Mile was not an organized protest. So what is the thinking about what it was?
Well, I mean, the police version of what happened as far as what organized this is, you mentioned that shooting. There was a shooting on the south side of Chicago yesterday where police wounded a 20-year-old man who they say shot at them. There was a big gathering of people, a lot of tension between police and residents after that shooting. Police say that basically, you know, an organized collection of people took advantage of that moment, basically when you have all the police in one place responding to protests, and went down in caravans. They described it as car caravans going down to the shopping district to loot. You know, he's saying not out of anger about the shooting, but rather just, you know, using it as an opportunity to try to steal high-end items.
Yeah, there was a temporary halt on train and bus services into downtown. The city's drawbridges were lifted to prevent more people from pouring in. Have officials been able to, you know, kind of restore order?
Yeah, the sort of vandalism and looting stopped early this morning, although I will say that even as late as 6 or 7 in the morning, there were still reports of people still stealing things or smashing windows, but that has all stopped and been stopped for many hours now. As you mentioned, they raised the bridges, and they're even going to be shutting off access to downtown again tonight, maybe for the foreseeable future. Yeah. I will say, the last time we had this kind of unrest, the city shut down access to downtown. And what ended up happening is we had a lot of looting and vandalism in other parts of the city. You're hearing concern already from people and elected officials that by closing off access to downtown, it's just going to kind of spread out the destruction today. Police say they have a plan in place to prevent that. And I don't mean to be fear-mongering. I'm not saying that will happen. It's just a concern from what happened last time.
Well, just in the minute we have, how are Chicagoans reacting, especially, you know, Black leaders?
Well, you know, you're hearing a lot of, and I mean, Mayor Lori Lightfoot is a Black leader here in the city of Chicago. Right. We've also heard from Black aldermen who say this is terrible. This is not the way to show your dissatisfaction, not the way to express your righteous anger. I've also heard from a lot of activists, you know, who are saying, you know, essentially the language of Martin Luther King Jr., which is that riots are the language of the unheard, that, you know, this is people taking their anger and frustration to the areas of the city where, you know, sort of hitting the city where it hurts in the pocketbook, and that this is an extension of the anger and protest that we've been seeing going on all year, all summer,
Patrick
I should
Smith,
say.
Yeah. Patrick Smith, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here in America, we are not having as many babies as we used to. Over the last 5 years, we've seen a drop in birth rates. And now, according to the CDC, rates are the lowest they've been in 35 years. Now experts are beginning to track how this global pandemic will impact the future of childbearing, affecting the makeup of generations to come. Christine Wieland is a professor of consumer science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and joins us now with more. Professor, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what are some of the reasons we're seeing birth rates in the United States so low?
First of all, birth rates have been falling consistently for the last several years. And we see it because people are getting married later. Women are pursuing their careers. And we are feeling the economic pressures of trying to wait until couples feel that they have enough money to have a child. Children are costly. And so there's that dual income earner trap.
What was happening 35 years ago? I'm curious as to why it was low then and now it's the lowest we've seen since then.
So there have been baby booms and baby busts throughout history. I mean, we can go back even further. We can look at the Great Depression. There was a baby bust at that point because the economic situation was so grim. Then you had a post-World War II baby boom, the baby boomer generation, as we call them. And then on and on, we've had some big and small birth cohorts over the years that have tracked economics and the sort of the global situation at hand. People tend not to choose to have children in times of uncertainty, whether it be around money or health. We have also seen a consistent lowering of the pregnancy rate among teens and younger folks as well. So that has contributed to a lower birth rate too.
Women in their 40s, though, are actually having more babies. Why is that?
In vitro fertilization and other assisted reproductive technologies have gotten so much better in the last decade or so, and that's allowing women to extend their reproductive years. So we are seeing women in their late 30s, early 40s, and even into their mid-40s having children with some extra medical help.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to make the distinction, though, that these women over 40 are of a certain class, as medical procedures are really very expensive.
Absolutely. These in vitro procedures can run $15,000 or more, and that's assuming you're using all of your own gametes. And so many people, as they're getting older, are using donor gametes, which makes things even more costly.
You know, we're 6 months into this global pandemic, but how do you think it will impact birth rates in the future, both here in the United States and really globally?
So here in the United States, the early indications are that the birth rate is going down even further. So we're seeing fewer women than normal pregnant right now, which makes sense. Infection, the concern about trouble in pregnancy, and also, again, the economic concern leads people to be more cautious. At the same time, though, we are seeing an increase in birth rates and pregnancies in some developing nations as access to contraception becomes more difficult to come by. So it's really a mixed bag on a global scale. But in the United States, I think our birth rate is going to drop even lower because of this pandemic.
What will this mean for the economy and the workforce?
When we have smaller generations and bigger generations, you know, this causes all sorts of challenges in terms of Social Security and retirement benefits and, you know, government benefits, who's going to be paying for who. However, there are some benefits in the short term to being in a smaller generation. It's easier to get into college. There's less competition for particular jobs. There can be a little bit of both with that. And as we come out of the pandemic, as we hopefully get into more secure economic times, we may see a baby boom similar to the 1950s post-World War II baby boom as we have a desperate attempt to return to a sense of normalcy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about how this will change family structures and dynamics. I imagine that generation will have to care for their parents at a much earlier age.
Absolutely. Right now we talk about the sandwich generation, where you're caring for young children and for elderly parents. But, you know, in the future, we may have a generation that is having children so much later themselves, in part because they are caring for their aging parents, and that mm-hmm. delays their childbearing years even further as they make the decision that they really can't or don't want to handle both.
So with all of this in mind, should we be alarmed by these numbers? How should we be processing this in the context of the moment?
I think the main thing to know is that on a national scale, on a global scale, all of this does go in cycles. So don't write off the family quite yet. There will be another baby boom. The challenge is, depending on women's age and people's economic conditions, it will affect certain families right now very directly. So you can take the large view, but know that for many people, this is a topic that's really hitting close to home.
Christine Wieland is a professor in the Department of Consumer Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump has denied reaching out to the South Dakota governor to have his face added to Mount Rushmore, as reported by the New York Times. The president tweeted that was fake news, although he added, sounds like a good idea to me. Meanwhile, a monument outside Atlanta, Georgia is getting more attention. In Stone Mountain Park, a massive tribute to the Confederacy, chiseled into rock, has become a focal point for a reckoning on racism. Emil Moffitt reports for WAB and the America Amplified Initiative.
A walk along a trail at Stone Mountain can be peaceful, but looming over all this natural beauty is a nearly 100-foot-tall carving of Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, and Jefferson Davis, all on horseback with their hats pressed against their hearts. The original design of the monument was created by Gutzon Borglum, the same sculptor who carved Mount Rushmore. Through the years, millions of people have stood in this spot and looked up, among them Beverly Clark of Jackson, Mississippi, who visited with her high school choir group in the 70s.
And it was just really exciting because it was the first time I had ever seen the carving. It was just magnificent.
Clark, who is white, taught elementary school, including Civil War history, in Jackson for years. Earlier this summer, news reports from Georgia caught her eye when on July 4th, armed African-American protesters marched on Stone Mountain, demanding the carving's removal. That prompted Clark to write a letter to leaders in DeKalb County, where the state park is located.
The fact that it is just a gorgeous piece of art, I don't see how anybody could want anything to happen to it. That's one of those things that just needs to be preserved for all time.
Preserved even if it honors the men who took up arms against the United States in defense of slavery. But Ed Williams, an African-American educator and community activist who lives in the Atlanta area, argues that the carving isn't as much about the Civil War as it is about more recent history.
I believe that the carving depicts a moment in time in our history where America embraced racism.
The tribute to the Confederacy wasn't actually completed until the early 1970s. That's 50 years after work began on it, and more than a century after the Confederacy fell.
There was big, huge issues with racism here in Georgia and throughout the South.
Williams became involved in efforts to either remove or modify the carving 5 years ago when protests erupted in Ferguson, Missouri, over the death of Michael Brown at the hands of police. And Williams says the most recent wave of protests makes a change at Stone Mountain even more pressing.
It's a realization to many Americans that racism still exists, and it's so obvious that that's something that we can no longer tolerate in the American psyche in our public squares.
He's gathering signatures on a petition and continues to press state lawmakers to make a change. And he has the attention of at least one at the Georgia Capitol, Democratic State Representative Shelley Hutchinson.
I would be okay if they just sandblasted it off. I mean, there's Stone Mountain in and of itself is some place to visit, and it's a nice park, and I'd love to bring my kids there, and I do not go there because of it.
In the final days of this year's legislative session, Hutchinson introduced a bill banning Confederate symbols on state property. But that would conflict with a current law passed in 2019 by Georgia's Republican-controlled General Assembly that prohibits the removal of monuments. The Stone Mountain Memorial Association says its hands are tied by that law. Still, in recent years, the association says they've done what they could to downplay the celebration of the Confederacy in the park to, quote, adjust to the changing feelings of the public on the issue. For Here and Now, I'm Emil Moffitt.
And his story is part of the America Amplified Initiative, a national public media collaboration focused on community engagement reporting.
One of the Senate seats Democrats are trying to flip in November is in the state of Colorado. That's where Republican Cory Gardner will face off against former governor and presidential candidate Democrat John Hickenlooper. And that's where we turn to for this week's Senate Tracker. Binta Berkland is a public affairs reporter for Colorado Public Radio and joins us with more. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
So, Binta, I want to start with Cory Gardner, who has held this seat since 2015. He calls himself a common sense conservative, and he was asked on Colorado Public Radio in July about his opposition to the Affordable Care Act, what he'd like to see in its place. Let's listen.
What I look forward to working on is a plan that protects people with pre-existing conditions, a plan that allows people to buy health insurance across state lines, that builds on the risk pools to drive down insurance, to build on the telemedicine work that we're doing. But I don't think socialized medicine is the right way to do it. In fact, Colorado...
Binta, how would you describe what Cory Gardner's record has been like in the Senate and what he's running on?
Well, when Gardner was first elected in 2014, he narrowly defeated a Democratic incumbent. And he ran on the idea that he will be a different kind of Republican. So he's a strong supporter of an all-of-the-above energy policy, including wind and solar. And he recently scored a political win with the passage of this bipartisan Great American Outdoors Act. And he sponsored that legislation. It's a public lands package, and it would help fix ailing national parks and help states and local communities get new lands for parks. And so Gardner's definitely positioning himself as someone who will work across the aisle on issues that are important to voters, like the outdoors.
Is he aligning himself with President Trump?
He definitely is, yes. He aligned with the president on impeachment, on a lot of the big issues. He's not split from President Trump. And he's one of only two Republican senators up for re-election in a state President Trump lost. And so he's walking this fine line between aligning himself with the president, which he needs to get Republicans who support the president. And I've talked to Republican voters who say, we want Gardner to back the president strongly. We don't want to see any daylight there at all, compared to a lot of other people who want to see incredible daylight and don't feel like he's been independent.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at Democrat John Hickenlooper, a former governor, as I mentioned, and presidential candidate. Here's a recent ad.
Our country's had a lot thrown at us, but we can come back stronger and more just than we were before. We can put an end to this era of corruption and chaos, the sense that Washington isn't even trying to make people's lives better. We've got to do everything we can to make a change.
Up against Gardner, what issues is Hickenlooper focused on?
He's definitely focused on this idea of going to Washington to change the dysfunction, get things done. When he was governor two terms, and then he was the Denver mayor for two terms, he was a popular governor, and Colorado had one of the strongest economies in the nation. And he tried to be a moderate force to get different groups together to build coalitions, and he was somewhat business friendly, especially with the oil and gas industry. He supports that industry. Another big thing we're hearing from Hickenlooper and Democrats is that he will stand up to President Trump. And this is one of the races that could determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. So for a lot of voters I've talked to, the race is bigger than Cory Gardner. The race is bigger than John Hickenlooper.
He's also had some missteps. He recently apologized for comments he made 6 years ago, comparing politicians to slaves being whipped to row an ancient slave ship. An ethics investigation also found he violated a state ethics law by accepting flights on private planes when he was a governor. Are those issues hurting him or coming up to the forefront?
They did in the primary, and I think they will again. I also covered a racial justice forum during the primary. It was at the height of the George Floyd protests, and one of the first questions a moderator asked was, what does the term Black Lives Matter mean to you? And he said it means all lives matter. That upset a lot of people. He apologized for that. He said he wasn't using that phrase in a way that some people were interpreting it to mean, but a lot of voters I talked to felt hurt that he was so out of step, or is that how he really feels? And so having said that, he won the primary by 20 percentage points. Mm-hmm. And he is popular. He's well-liked. I think those issues will matter, but for a lot of voters, there's bigger concerns at play with control of the Senate and everything that's going on nationally.
So it sounds like you've spoken with a lot of voters, but what do polls say about this race?
One of the polling groups called Morning Consult was one of the most recent polls, and it has Hickenlooper up by 6 points over Gardner. And as a comparison, the same poll has Joe Biden up by 13 points in Colorado over President Trump. So because Gardner and Trump are linked, the political analysts I've talked to have said that, you know, Trump has to narrow his margin fairly significantly for Gardner to have a chance here, because there will be some split ticket voters, but it's not going to be a huge percentage of people that don't vote for Trump but do support Gardner.
Binta Berkland is a public affairs reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.